morning. It's Saturday, June 28th, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP in Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, your host for Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with the writer, Nancy Means Wright. Nancy Means Wright is the author of 15 books of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. Her adult mystery series features Vermont dairy farmer Ruth Wilmarth, most recently Mad Cow Nightmare, published by St. Martin's Press. The pea soup poisonings, based on her children's childhood adventures, won an Agatha Award for 2006 Best Children's YA Novel. A sequel, The Great Circus Train Robbery, was published this spring by Hilliard and Harris Publishers. Her short stories and poems have appeared in numerous anthologies and dozens of magazines, including American Literary Review, 17, Green Mountains Review, Carolina Quarterly, and Red Book. A former Breadloaf Scholar, grant winner from the Society of Children's Book Writers, current scholar for the Vermont Humanities Council, play director, and longtime teacher, she lives on a dirt road in Cornwall with her husband and two Maine coon cats. I interviewed Nancy at her home in May. I asked her how her writing career got started.
I always wanted to be a writer, and I think, I remember in sixth grade we had to write an autobiography and say what we wanted to do when we were grown up, and I said I wanted to be an actress, which I've partially been. Spent a lot of my many years doing acting and directing, and I wanted to be a writer, so I wrote my first novel in fourth grade, inspired by Nancy Drew, which all of us have read. I don't know if you did, but even my own kids
did.
And it was about a particularly obnoxious older brother that I had, and my mother was not too happy about it. I guess she thought she had an incipient juvenile delinquent or something living in the house, and so she threw it out. She threw it out, the whole thing. But anyway, so that was my first novel, and I never wrote another mystery after that for years and years and years. But I did write other kinds of things, of course.
Now I know you work in many genres. You've mm-hmm. written poetry and mm-hmm. Stories, novels, mysteries,
right.
And children's mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
So do you tend to focus more on certain genres than others these days?
It's hard to say. I think probably fiction is my forte, although I've always been doing a lot of poems. I think when I finish, say, something long, when I finish a novel, then I just take some time off and just write a poem. What really happened was I was divorced back in 1990, and living here in Vermont, of course, right next door on Sidemill Road, and I went down to teach in a small liberal arts college down in Poughkeepsie, New York. And while I was down there, just because of the divorce, I guess, I couldn't seem to write anything long, so I began to, so that's when I really started writing a lot of poems.
Yeah.
I always had written poems off and on, sporadically, but hadn't sent them out much. But it was really started to send out. I wrote about 100 poems, and then won a little chapbook prize for of poems, and that really just sort of got me going. And then after that, I got back into writing the mystery. I decided that an amateur sleuth is really just like the writer, you know, trying to find out who'd done it and why, and sort of fumbling about while they're trying to find out. And so it would really would, in one sense, sort of be myself, not exactly myself. I mean, you make a lot of changes. I decided that she would be a farm wife. And so then I just gave her on hardscrabble farm, and my former husband has a lot of relatives who are farmers in the area, and so I knew them and had a lot of experience and watched births of cows and that sort of thing, a lot of hanging out with cows. And then I gave her three children, sort of similar to my four, based on my four to some degree,
right.
And just created the whole fictional town of Branbury, Vermont. It could be Brandon, it could be Middlebury, it could be Cornwall, Bridport, you know, whatever, just any small town, really, in
right,
Vermont.
Right, right. And that was Mad Season?
And that was Mad Season.
Okay.
And so that was how the first one came about, and then luckily I got a publisher for it, St. Martin's Press.
And that's turned into a series.
Pretty quickly, and that's a series of five
Now, I wanted to ask you about the middle grade series, the first of which is the Pea Soup Poisonings. And then the next one just came out, The Great Circus Train Robbery. I was curious, there's some pretty scary stuff that happens in in mysteries. And when you have to write a mystery for children, well, in Pea Soup Poisoning, some of the maybe scarier themes are abandonment, theft, murder, and kidnapping. Those are all in present in the book. And I'm just curious, how do you recommend managing frightening themes in children's books?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Actually, I worried after I had finished writing the book because I did have... What happens is an old lady dies from, presumably from eating pea soup, although at the end of the book I did suggest that she had a heart problem too. So that might help a little bit. But it happens off stage. I mean, in writing a middle grade novel, pretty much you try to keep anything like a killing or a murder if it happens off stage.
Right.
And not on. And in the Great Circus Train Robbery, it's a theft.
Okay.
It's not a murder at all. So that's a part of it, and I think, so there is some risky behavior, but I do try, anytime there's risky behavior, going into somebody's house and sneaking around when they're not supposed to be in there, and some ogre of a man might catch them any moment, I try to have a backup somehow, so that they have these two old ladies, and they, in some to some degree, are backups. For example, when Zoe, the two main characters are named after my two oldest grandchildren, and when Zoe goes into a house to look around while the people are away. She knows that one of the old ladies is going to be looking out the window and knows she's in there. So
watching after her.
Yeah. And also that there's the old suspension of disbelief that you have. But you have to scare the kids a little bit. You
know. Sure, and they like that, actually.
Yeah, yeah. And the whole thing, I should say, if it's okay to... based on my own children's childhood, that's the only reason I guess I started writing. I hadn't even planned it to be a series, and I hadn't even planned it to be a mystery to begin with, but... we had seven kids living with us one summer when my husband's brother was going up in an airplane working for IBM, and it crashed, and so he was alive but barely, and so we brought his kids up to our house. And what they did, they started the spy club, and to get into the spy club you had to walk on this old beam that overlooks a rusted machinery. You saw that in
the
book.
Right, in the book.
And Zoe is determined to do it, even though she's the only girl, because she wants to get into the spy club, and the guys say no, and her older brother, who is based on my oldest son.
Oh, I was going to say, there's still some sibling rivalry in your...
there is, and Kelby is my oldest son. I haven't told him this yet. He's a hockey coach now. So during that summer, I was going to the French school. I was getting a master's degree in here at the French school.
At Middlebury.
Summer school at Middlebury, yeah. And so it was really hard. Suddenly I had seven kids to feed, and so my husband made his pea soup in great five-gallon vats, and he was serving it in a chamber pot. I mean, it was a reconstituted, cleaned-out chamber pot, but that... Kids didn't care about that. They just about threw up whenever they looked at the soup. It was so that's how I got the idea of the pea soup poisonings, and then I had to have somebody to poison, so I thought of this another fictional old lady down the street who was a friend of the other two old ladies who lived across the street. And so I just had somebody put an insecticide into the soup.
Now, I'm curious, have you ever had anyone take offense at being represented fictionally in your works? Because obviously you let your real life seep into your creative life.
I haven't. As I said, the latest one, The Great Circus Train Robbery, a lady had won the chance to be a character in one of my books. And I was a little bit worried about that. She was a retired librarian. And so I thought, well, I'll make her a librarian. And she told me quite a bit about her life and some strange ailment disease that she had. And so I kept all of that pretty much. And of course I did put some other words in her mouth. I mean, because she's a fairly pivotal character in that she gets these kids. She has a niece or an adoptive niece who works in a circus, who is a clown in a circus, which gets the kids into the circus where they find some shenanigans going on, and help solve the mystery of the rail train which is gone. So I've just sent that to her. It just came out really last in April. Came out about mid-April, almost a month ago. And I sent her copies, and I haven't heard a word from her yet. I hope she's happy with it. But I did try to treat her, you know, really lovingly. I mean, I love the character that I turned her into.
Yeah.
And it was based on what she told me about herself. It was also based on photographs that she told me herself. So I hope that that's going to work.
Well, I would think that you take a little bit of a risk when you win that opportunity and
you
say,
do.
Yes, I want to go with
it. And I have heard from other authors who, I go to a lot of big mystery conferences around the country, and we all talk. And that's one of the things that people talk about sometimes. Some people have had problems. But then I had also written a memoir called Make Your Own Change that came back out in the very late, I think 89, almost 190. And that was about how we've just made a life along with a living here in Vermont by running a shop, a craft shop, mm-hmm. Cornwall Crafts. I don't know if everyone bought it. It was here in Cornwall. And I left everybody's name in it, a lot of people's name, just as they are. I didn't even change the names in that memoir, because it was true. I mean, it was a true memoir. Mm-hmm. And of course, that was my bestseller ever, because we down at the Vermont bookshop, everybody kept buying it, thinking he or she might be in it, I guess, or wondering, uh-oh, if they were. I only had one person in that book who was a little bit upset, because she said her father, who was this wonderful, delightful man, I might have misrepresented in some of the dialogue that I put in his mouth. But she was the only one, and... So I've been so lucky. I guess that's why I haven't worried so much lately about
putting something else. Well, I think the publisher's legal department also tends to look at these things and think about these things.
They look carefully, to be sure. And St. Martin's has good lawyers. But I think what we do is, you know, we take ourselves and say you and myself and memory, and then and maybe somebody else, and make it all into one person and give a distinctive voice, and then... exaggerate a little, the real truth. This is what I tell my kids whenever they see themselves in a book. The greater truth is in the book. Never mind if things are not represented or if the actual facts are not always true.
Right.
So,
I read on your website this sentence that caught my eye, and I wanted to ask you about it. You wrote, whether inspired by a situation, place, or social issue, the plot in my novels inevitably stems from a flaw in one or more of my characters.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about how flawed characters make for good books?
Yeah, I mean, I love flawed characters.
They're so much more interesting.
I love flawed people and quirky characters. And I think that a book really, whether it's a mystery or whatever, especially a mystery, because a mystery can be really formulaic, and I try not to make it wholly formulaic, except that it has to have a mystery, and it has to, a murder or something, and it has to sort of, things have to come out in the end. But I think that a book should start with the character and with a flaw in the character, and let that determine what the plot is about. For example, in the second one, in the series, Harvest of Bones, I used my husband's great aunt. I call her my great aunt too, because she lived with us for a while, who lived here in Weybridge and went to Middlebury College, used to ride her horse right up into Mead Chapel. Almost got thrown out for doing that.
Into
Mead Chapel.
Like into the inside of Mead Chapel?
Into the inside. She was crazy, absolutely. Oh, she's a wild woman. Died when she was 90. But anyway, and she never got married until she was in her middle 40s, and to this proofreader from the New York Times. So she'd been working down in New York City. And after five, they never got along. It was always arguing. And after 5 years, he disappeared, and family legend says that she did him in. We don't know. But I sort of played the what-if game again for that, and she had, we all adored her, but she had a temper. She really had a temper. And I think more than once she might have gone after somebody with a pitchfork or her former husband, and I certainly had her do that in Harvest of Bones. And so out of that flaw is the novel, just the whole comes out of the flow. Whenever possible, I like to, to have a short story or a novel or something come out of that flaw. And plus, flawed people are much more interesting, much more fun.
Do you think that makes us feel like we can relate to them more because they're not perfect?
Because most of us are.
Because no,
yeah, do you know anybody who's perfect?
No,
I don't.
Not really.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I know that you are you're working on a book right now that draws on your own family history, or mm-hmm. or is it your grandparents' history?
It's my family's history in the sense that it's my grandmother and my great-grandmother who were involved, or starting back then. It's called Queens Never Make Bargains out of Alice in Wonderland, if you recall.
Right,
it's
sure.
where, the Red Queen out there, Queens Never Make Bargains, she screams at it. And so I've been working on this for 15 or 20 years. My family is originally from Scotland, and my former husband and I went over to Scotland to go to the archives in Edinburgh to look up my great-grandmother's birth. And the woman came out with this little slip of paper and went up and handed it to me. And there was one word on it, and it said illegitimate. And I thought, oh, goodness. Something mother never said. And mother, who had this big family, she was one of 13. And so I thought, well, that's really interesting. And after a couple of scotches, for which Scotland is very well known, I thought, well, I got to put that in writing somewhere. So I just began to do all kinds of research. What happened was that my grandmother came over as a 17-year-old by herself to marry my grandfather, whose first wife had died in childbirth after about 6 children.
Was it fun to write?
It was wonderful fun
to do the research?
It was great fun, because she comes over in about 1910. And so I had to research World War I, because I have a character involved in it. I had to research all of that awful Spanish influenza that afflicted the characters. And then World War II. The novel goes from 1910 up to up until 1945, when through 3 generations of women. So I'm doing it in 3 different voices.
It's a big project.
And I had originally started to do the whole thing in letters. I must have done 3,000 words on this. And I didn't ever send it anyplace. I've been trying to get it into some kind of form, and now I've reduced it to about 300 pages, which took some doing, getting all those letters down into.
And all 3 sections are one novel. You're not doing it.
No, they're all one novel. But the characters who come out in the first part of it, in the Jesse scene. Jesse was the name of my mother too, so I use that name. Those characters come through come back and forth through the next 2 voices as well.
Okay.
So we'll just see what happens. It's only at its first publisher now, so we'll just see.
Right.
See what. And then there was a section of it that was in 17 magazine, so it has had some. It has seen the world, and so.
How do you do that? How do you get an excerpt of a novel published in 17 magazine? Did they call you?
Well, no, they didn't. Actually, what happened with that was I just sent it out. I do a lot. I write a lot of short stories, and I have a lot in just in literary magazines, American Literary Review, and magazines like that. So you just write the story and then just send it out. And to my surprise, they took the story as a novelette, I guess is what they called it, because it was a long short story.
And how long ago was that?
And that was back in the mid-80s somewhere. That was when I was just beginning all this research.
Oh, okay.
So it was a while back. I don't think they're doing as many short stories now.
Right. I was wondering, because I know Red Book used to do stories.
I did stories from Red Book too, and then now they don't do any more stories.
Yeah, a lot of the larger magazines have
just
dropped it.
Yeah. In fact, I mean, that's the problem even with publishing in general, that there's a lot more nonfiction being published than fiction. Mm-hmm. And a lot of publishers, I guess, are even drawing up some of their fiction markets. So
yeah,
it's just difficult.
And I suppose you've been writing for a period of time in which you would have seen a lot of change
Yeah, my first novel came out in 1973. It was not a mystery, so I've been writing for a long time.
Right.
I mean, publishing.
So when would you say most of this change happened within the publishing industry?
You know, a lot of it, I suppose, I mean, so breathtaking. A lot of it's with modern technology. I mean, things happening, and the internet suddenly has just made an enormous difference, because now, you know, people can multiple submit. I mean, you know, simultaneous submit, multiple submit, whatever. So it's just, so it is a different world.
Right.
And since you can, and since with a computer, I think the computer too, that's made a big difference. With, like, when did I get my first computer? I guess it was 1986 was my first computer. And all of a sudden, like, I remember my first novel, well, I had to retype that about 10 times, even to change one sentence. And now you can just change a word, like, and you can send it all over the place.
You can change a character's name by doing a finder and replace for 300 pages.
Exactly.
That's amazing.
It's incredible. You know, I think of Jane Austen and Charlotte Bronte scratching with their pens. You know?
Right.
Imagine that, those days. God. So I guess that's where it seems to have changed. And even more recently than that, probably in the last 8 years, I have many, many friends who are just after 3 or 4, this is in the mystery world, after 3 or 4 novels, even sometimes after just 3 novels being dropped, if the novel doesn't make it or break out after the first 3 novels, they're just going to drop people and try somebody else who might break out faster and catch the public eye. So it's just happening over and over and over again. I go to mystery conferences, and people that I've known and been on panels with and whatnot, just not there anymore because they've been dropped. And now there's a lot of people are going to the small presses, and the small presses are bringing people out. I just was in a hurry, so I just wanted to get, so I went to a small press. And it's kind of fun working with a small press.
Do you need an agent to go to a small press?
You don't, and I do have an agent. My agent knew I was doing this, but she wasn't interested, because she will only try the big presses. I mean, she's a business person.
Sure.
You know,
yeah.
Let's face it.
Right.
So I just did these two on my own.
I want to ask you to read an excerpt from
your
book. But before we, I just want to say this is Nancy Means Wright reading from The Great Circus Train Robbery, which is published by Hilliard and Harris.
I'm just going to read just a really small section of this. This is when Zoe, my character Zoe, who wants to be lieutenant in her brother Kelby's spy club, has been assigned to spy on a very suspicious neighbor. And she's lying in the bushes behind his house and writing down his every movement at this point. She heard a crackle in the bushes and something slithered over one foot. A snake? She shrieked and a door banged open at the back of the house. Boomer's belly filled the doorway. "Who's there?" he hollered. She peered up at him. His face was coarse and unshaven, like he wanted to grow a beard but didn't have enough hairs. "He might be a fugitive from justice, Kelby," her brother said, which was why 2 weeks ago Boomer had rented this yellow house in the small town of Branbury, Vermont, and hardly ever, ever went out of doors. He was afraid of being recognized, Kelby had said. "He's hiding something, some terrible secret. It's up to us to find out what it is." "Up to me, you mean," she said. "If you want to be a lieutenant," he said. She did want to, but she didn't want to be caught by this man who had this terrible secret. Hearing him step off the back porch, she pushed her face down into the crabgrass. Then, uh-oh, a sneeze coming on. She stuck 2 fingers under her nose to stop the sneeze, but still it came out. "Who's there?" he roared, and a pair of black boots stomped toward her hiding place. "Show your face. If it's one of you meddlesome kids, I'm calling the police." She inched back. Now she was the snake in the grass. But she was too big for a snake. Any minute he'd see her and nab her for trespassing. The police would take her to jail, and then what would her parents say? She heard a loud shrilling, like a scream in the night. It came again and again, only it wasn't yet night, and it wasn't a scream. It was the ring of a cell phone. "Hello? What? Huh? Just a minute. Can't hear so well. I have to go inside." The back door slammed. Saved by a phone call. She peered in through the window, and there he was, talking on his phone. She wanted to leave this minute in case he came back out, but she wasn't off duty yet. "Boomer," shaking a fist, she wrote in her notebook. "Boomer," yelling into the phone, pacing the floor. "Boomer," knocking a pile of books off a shelf. "Boomer," Now she was too excited to write. Boomer had a sulfur pillar in his hands. He was slamming his fist into it, slamming and banging and punching, then flinging himself face down on the couch. Who was he mad at? His girlfriend told him off, she wrote. Then she crossed it out. He was too old for a girlfriend. Could have been an ex-wife. Somebody found out something bad he did, she wrote, and he didn't want them telling. Found out what? She was writing so fast it looked like chicken tracks. Okay, he beat somebody up and was in hiding. Right here. 2 houses away from her own. Next door to her friend Spence, who helped her put away the pea soup poisoners.
Thank you very much. Her sneezes get her in a lot of trouble.
Oh, yes, yes, right.
She has hay fever.
Yes, yes, yes. And I always had allergies. So I guess I gave her my allergies.
I want to mention your website. You have a lot of great information on there about your own work and also for other people, you know, links to interesting things. So
how to find an agent for one.
Yeah. That was a funny story. Yeah, that's a great story. So your website is www.nancymeanswrite.com. Mm-hmm. And it's means right is meanswright.com. My last question for you is for writers who might be listening. I'm wondering if you can recommend an exercise or an activity that has helped you in the past when you've had trouble moving forward with a piece of writing.
Okay. Well, as I finish my morning's writing, what I try always to do is to never quite complete a scene. I try to end before the scene is quite done. And in that way, when I come back to it the next morning, I know where I am. I know pretty much where I'm going because I often will write down a couple of notes what I think is going to happen. And then there's something else that I do. I always think of my writing and my characters as being on stage. I see them. I really try to visualize them up there on the stage, the way they use their props, what their reactions are, the responses, their body language in particular. If I still have a bit of a problem and maybe I think it's not going to work out quite so well, what I will do sometimes is to go back and read aloud what I've written up to that point. And then again, use this technique of looking at my characters up there on the stage, so they're beyond me. And often that will really get me into writing the rest of the scene. Sometimes if I'm not sure where a novel's going to go, and I never know. I mean, I'm always at least halfway or more than halfway through a novel before I know what it's really about, even. Before I go to bed, I'll put, say, a question that I have into my head. Just talk a little bit to myself about what I need to know. And the next morning when I get up, it will have been in a dream, and not necessarily in the dream with the characters that I'm working with, or even the same ambiance or the same setting that I've been doing, but something slant. I mean, something that happens in another part of my life that still would be relevant to this scene, and then it just seems to work.
That's cool.
Next morning, you know, we figure these things out.
Well, maybe we can relax a little bit and let go of what's holding us back.
Yeah, that's
the
probably part
state.
Of it. Yeah,
that's
gets
very
rid of our
smart.
Frustrations.
And I love the advice to stop before you finish a scene, because I would think that when you go back to it, you can pick up more easily on whatever momentum you had.
That's
the day
right.
Before. That's
and it's hard to do
smart.
Because you really want to finish that scene.
Nancy, it was really nice to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Great. Well, thank you so much. It's great.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Nancy Means Right. Next week, tune in at the same time to hear the first half of an interview with author, UVM professor, and award-winning blogger, Philip Baruth. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live every Saturday morning at www.theradiator.org. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or events for next week's Bookworms calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMMLP in Burlington, Vermont.